Welcome back, everybody, to another fun episode of the Rolex Whiskey Passion Project. As I promised, I'm going to keep bringing them people who love the spirits, especially the passion. Gentlemen, today, super excited because I've actually had a little bit of history with the company he's working with right now and the company he used to work with. Well, without further ado, Jamie Ritchie, welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on the show, Gavin.
No worries. You want to tell the audience a little bit of, you know, a brief little CV, what you've been up to? You've had a pretty glorious career.
Yeah, it's been a fun time. I was with Sotheby's for 32 years, so I joined them in London in 1990. And yeah, it was just a London-based business then. And I moved to New York in 94 when we opened up the New York wine market and lived in the US ever since. And opened up our wine business in Hong Kong and then France in 2021. And we really started getting into the spirits business when we saw the sales go from 1% to 3% to 5%, primarily through Sonny McAllen and Moutai in Hong Kong. It was at that time where we really started exploring, what it meant to set up a separate spirits business at Sotheby's rather than just being really in the wine business and selling some occasional bottles of whiskey and cognac.
I think you're spot on. Not to stop you there, but you're spot on. That's exactly when Sotheby's head popped up, when there was girls came in strong. Last year in Scotland, I was at Distillers One of One. I mean, that's a hell of an event.
Yeah, so that was amazing. But so what we did was we created the single liter sale model in the wine business, and when we went into the spirits business, we started up. We recruited spirits professionals in 2019. And we really wanted to replicate the same model we were doing in wine with spirits. So we sourced the Ultimate Whiskey Collection, which actually came from North Carolina. And we shipped it over to London because the secondary market in the US was virtually non-existent at that time. We, rather than hosting the auction in our sort of traditional premises at New Bond Street, we decided to put it together with the cars and do a drink and dry auction, even though our press team wouldn't let us say that. Yeah, we had a McAllen bar, we had the whiskey on display with the cars, and then we sold before the cars. And that was really the first sort of significant sale. It was $4 million worth of whiskey, and it sold for just under 10. Yeah, we're getting at the price, at the time, the highest price for the McAllen 26-60-year-old, which was $1.9 million. So that really launched Sotheby's on the spirits market in the way that we sort of intended to. And to the Distillers One of One, which I put together with Jonathan Driver from the Worshipful Company Distillers. And that's just an incredible auction, which does raises the profile of whiskey and raises some great funds for Scotland, for the underprivileged people in Scotland.
I was blown away. I mean, I don't stop talking about that event because, literally, it's just nothing but good comes out of that. You got the Scotch houses that step up and bring their best, for that one of one. And what it does for these underprivileged kids is insane. And the way it's all managed. Like I spoke to with Jonathan about it, it's really it's so well organized and sets these kids up for success. It's beautiful.
I mean, the way that it really brought the whiskey business together and it showcases their innovation and their passion and their care. And obviously the funds are used for such great cause for underprivileged children. So well presented, so well done. It's been really accretive to the Scotch whiskey business.
You obviously have been involved in quite a few events with the Scotch whiskey people from Scotland, and it's very rare to get everyone under one roof like that.
Yes.
With nothing. Watching, I was fortunate to go for the lunch the day before. I think there was 20 of us in the room. And that was Johnny was going through Fowler was going through the whole thing, and we were just holy shit. But then that night, all of the distillers were there and they were all standing with their bottles. And just that excitement in the room of having all these amazing creative individuals was really what got me just totally, awestruck. And I'm like, wow, you got 30, 40 different of some of the greatest brains in whiskey making in this one room.
Yeah. I mean, everyone shows up. And also, everyone puts their best innovation and thoughts towards it. And so you've got not only just great whiskey, but you also get the auction format. It's done in a beautiful way. And, Sotheby's do a live stream that's sort of equally impressive in terms of presentation. So for those people who can't be there, who are bidding remotely, Yeah, they get pretty wound up and excited by the whole process. And yeah, it is, yeah, the live auction business has changed quite a lot because it's now very difficult to get a lot of people congregated in one place because the remote tools are so good. You can use your phone, you know,
so good.
I can bid. And
you
so,
can set your bids and not care. For the, how is that from you, from like a wine to whiskey? Kind of, I mean, a lot different or not really? Like the buyer.
So the auction process is the same. The values are different because...
No. But I meant for you, like for you, when you were at Sotheby's, like when, all, you know, how was that for you getting into that part?
For me, it was super, super interesting because wine and whiskey are, you know, whilst they're both great drinks and enjoyable and you share them and you have fun with them, you know, they're very different marketplaces. You sell wine mostly by the case or multiple bottles.
Yep.
And whiskey you sell by the individual bottle. You know, a bottle of wine is one and done in a night. You know, when you pull the cork, you're going to drink all of it. You know, whiskey you could share over many different occasions with many different people. So, and the collectors are very different. You know, you think that the Venn diagrams and model pieces is a significantly large piece. It's not really in reality. Whiskey collectors tend to be different types of people, enjoy different things than the wine collectors. So it really is a sort of different audience, different marketplace. So for me, yeah, after many years of being in the wine business, to open up and start the spirits business and move into that was, yeah, super interesting. And yeah, I had to learn an awful lot about, yeah, the whiskey and the spirits business in comparison to wine and how to be successful in that area.
Well, you know, and I tell people that in the whiskey business, there's amazing whiskey, but not all of it is investable or collectible. You know, it just isn't. You know, it's like if you're going to decide to go down that rabbit hole of buying, you know, like I did 8 years ago, it's like you want to pick stuff that literally is as good as having cash in hand. Now, it might not always be as much cash as you want, but like you know that you can go anywhere and be like, hey, I got a Macallan. Hey, I got the Pappy Van Winkle. Hey, I got, and people will be like, I'll buy it right now. But I think what I've seen the last few years is the people that saved the day for many, many years, the unspoken bottlers, aka the independent bottlers, who kept a lot of these distilleries open by buying full barrels. Like, they're now starting to see their time in the sun, you know, where it's like you look at like people who the Springbank releases. And even, you know, until Glen Grant reopened, like the Glen Grants, like the older ones, you know, you're kind of like, wow, those were like the people that were like kind of keeping these places open and they weren't hitting the high marks of a Macallan. But now you go pick up an independent bottle of Macallan, you know, from that era, you know, the 60s, the 70s, it's like that's worth a lot more money than they ever thought it would be.
Oh, but that's for sure. And I mean, yeah, the distilleries don't necessarily have the inventories that the Gordon and MacPhail's or the Duncan Taylors, et cetera, do have. And so I think you're absolutely spot on. It's super interesting as to, you know, where the market's evolved to. And it's evolving in different ways. This concept of premiumization, which everyone sort of talks about and loves. Yeah, there's difficult difference between, you know, selling something that's really great and premiumizing your business in terms of the liquid quality being really great, or just, you know, putting a new label on and raising the price. Interesting.
Which, you know, everybody got kind of caught with their pants down the last 3 years doing that. You're like, wait, why did you just raise the same thing? Can you tell me, you know, we don't have to say anything. It's what it is. This X18 is now $150 more expensive, MSRP. And you're like, huh, interesting.
Right. Is that all? And you know, the independent bottlers, which you mentioned, you know, they have some really great inventories of some really interesting liquids. And I think as the evolution goes on, in the whiskey business, through the recent sort of premiumization phase, I think maybe some of the focus has not been so much on quality. And I think at the end of the day, as we see a tougher, tighter marketplace, you're going to see a lot more people focusing on actually the quality of the liquid in the bottle and verifying the quality of the liquid in the bottle. So I don't know, what do you see on that front?
Oh, 100. I mean, listen, you know, it's very common, some of those older Macallans, people are like, well, would you really know? I don't know. You know, I see the fake pictures and the real pictures, and you're like, man, like they were pretty close that time.
Sure.
You know, and that's been a plague of all the top names that once again, like I'm saying, that you can turn into liquid pretty cash pretty quickly. You know, I've got a couple of bottlings of Macallan from like the 80s, you know, which I have had verified and all that, you know, and it's kind of like, wow, like I could see how somebody who wasn't paying attention could really think that they got a great deal. And I always tell people, like, there's no such thing as a great deal. Yes, you could be in the middle of nowhere and find a Dusty sitting on a shelf. And that would happen maybe 5 years ago. But now there's like professional hit teams that scour the earth looking for those because they know what the value is.
Yeah, yeah, there's very little of those, you know, finds that are available. You're dead right. Yeah, where when people see something, at an advantageous price, it doesn't make sense, etc. It normally doesn't make sense for a good reason. Authenticity is one of the things which we runs across the wine and spirits business. Yeah, there's a lot of challenges in with both.
I think is a good segue into what you're doing now, because that's what I love about Block Bar. Kind of like, hey, this is it. This is as provenance can be.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the attractions for me in moving from Sotheby's after 32 years to Block Bar, which is, Sotheby's founded in 1744 and Block Bar's founded in 2021, was, having dealt with authenticity issues and provenance issues, every week of the year for 32 years, to move to a model which essentially, guarantees the provenance only, is direct from consumer, direct from producer to consumer, and only works directly from the producer. And uses obviously blockchain to provide the authenticity of guarantees of authenticity and provenance and condition. For me, that was very appealing in the model that Block Bar operates.
Well, and for me, because I got a couple of bottles on the network, was I don't have to bring them to my house. Like, I'm not going to open these bottles. These are not something I want to drink. I'm a collector. Don't get me wrong. I got 300 open bottles that I couldn't even drink in my lifetime with friends. But that's a whole other story. But I like the fact that, like, hey, if I'm going to sell it at some point anyway, and I'm just, my analogy in the beginning of Block Bar was, it was like going to a sneaker store when Air Jordans were first released and nobody knew what it would happen. They were just like, oh, cool, there's a basketball shoe. So these first releases from some of these distilleries, like, that's it. That's the Air Jordan online of that distillery, when they did the Ardbeg one that was like aged, in the peat beneath the ground, I'm like, those Ardbeg people, like, they're almost a cult. And I say that in a really nice way, but like, they won't pay anything for something like that. And I'm like, I know, Brandon, I'm grabbing two of those, leaving it up there. And I get offers weekly, like, hey, somebody wants to buy it. I'm like, not yet. Like, I'm not liquidating the stuff for another 7.5 years, and I can't wait to do it, all of my stuff. Because it's been a great investment strategy for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you buy smart and you know what you're doing, then obviously the return has been phenomenal, particularly over the last few years. But I mean, we can't forget that, for many years, it started kicking off in 2000 and I would say 17 in the secondary market, at least. And, before then, it was less of a guaranteed bet. Obviously, when you got into it, it was exactly the right time. Yeah, and the rewards are great. And Ardbeg release was the most successful release on Block Bar. It was, it was the right quantity, the right price, the right timing.
For the right target. That community is a diehard, die by the Ardbeg sword group. You're offending them if you don't speak Ardbeg with them. I'm here for the investment. Don't give me shit. I see an opportunity here and I'm going to go on there because I see that this won't happen again, especially in that capacity. And that worked out well.
Yeah, it is as well, really well. Actually, one of the interesting things about it is that the Ardbeg releases also had the highest percentage of redemptions. So you talk about that community of being ardent. Yes. So they're ardent. There's people like you who've seen it as an opportunity to invest, and there are lots of people who have seen it as like, I want that bottle, and I'm taking it. And our model is not just about buying something and keeping it in our storage and being able to trade it. It's we love redemption. Bottles of wines and spirits are made there to be consumed and shared with friends.
It's also interesting because like one time I was at a very high end whiskey tasting, and the gentleman next to me, and you brought this kind of up earlier, he had a $55 million wine collection.
Okay.
Very wealthy individual. Didn't obviously didn't show me his finances, but he was just like, I'm like, well, so why are you here? And he's like, listen, man, when you pop that cork, the bottle is done.
Yeah.
He's like, that's it. You know, and I like, so I said, what do you drink? You know, and he's like, well, you know, on average, you're drinking a $4,000 to $5,000 bottle every time you're opening it. And then when you do like boys poker night, you want to like one up each other and you will bring like a $20,000 bottle and then it's done. He said, I kind of like this whiskey thing because like you can nurse that bottle for like 2 years if you want to. And he said, I don't give a shit about the money. It's more about the experience is gone. When that bottle of wine is gone, you got to go reach for another one. When the whiskey, like the sip, you're like, hey, I'll revisit that. But it's where what I also took from him that night was, here I am. I'm always trying to, it's an investment for me. So I'm looking to get a good price with a potential good return. A guy like that just wants to have fucking great drinks. He's got money. It doesn't matter to him. You know, I go into liquor stores and they'll get something and I'm like, well, I know what you paid for it. You're like, Gavin, a plastic surgeon will walk in here and pay the $5,000. You're trying to haggle me down to $1,000? Like, why would I do that? Do you know what I had to do to get that bottle? I'm like, you're 100% right. Like, you need to make your money because, you know, the way the three-tier distribution is set up over here, to get that one bottle that's worth $5,000, the guy's got to buy like 30 cases of vodka, 20 cases of champagne, a bunch of gin that he'll never sell, and just to get that one bottle to have it on his shelf. So I think like with Block Bar, you're disrupting that old ecosystem.
Yeah, there is some disruption to it. I think, from our perspective, we try and make sure that it brings transparency and traceability.
Mm-hmm. And accessibility. The fact that you have, like, everyone that I spoke to when I worked with Block Bar was kind of like, isn't this kind of cool? Because you've got your regular, you know, your three-tier system or your distribution model. You've got your duty-free model. You've got your distillery gift shop model. And now you have a fourth way to get your brand out there and bring in revenue.
Unbelievably successfully. And as you said, it is a semi distribution channel. And obviously it appeals, it's the global audience, so it's a global marketplace because that's the nature of how it works. And yeah, once anyone buys, you can just store it. And yeah, we take care of the storage. Yeah, and it's free with insurance until 2030. And or you can choose to gift it to anyone. Yeah, you can sell it if you choose to, or you can redeem it and take possession. And so it gives everyone the flexibility of that. I think in terms of the price of wine and whiskey, yeah, you said, yeah, you can drink it multiple days, you know, weeks, months, etc. And I think, yeah, the record price for a bottle of whiskey is now $2.7 million. The previous one was the same account, 26, yeah, which was $1.9 million, which when I was the fortunate auctioneer for that. And yeah, the highest price of a bottle of wine is $580,000. I sold back in 2015. And I think the difference in price reflects the length of drinking, as you said. Yeah. So what can you get? Yeah. 30, 35 tastes of 6-year-old Macallan. You know, where's she getting, you know, 8 to 10 pours of a glass of wine? So I think that's the difference.
Real quickly, like, and, you know, like the wine is so, you know, being fortunate to try some great wine, like it's so good, you forget to savor it. Like, you're ready to crack the second bottle. You know, you're so in the moment, you're like, and then it's gone.
And the, third pull. Yeah.
Yeah, because now you're in it.
Yeah. And you never see pictures of a wine tasting well with one or two bottles. Yeah. It's always a good lineup. And so, yeah. And so it's
such a good thing. Now, I feel like champagnes are having this huge resurgence. I'm seeing all these like vintage bottles of champagne pop out, which, you know, you and I both know the storage of that is, you know, if you thought wine was iffy on storage, champagne is real iffy.
Champagne, if it's kept in a great cellar, and obviously it's much more sensitive to the light, so it needs to be kept in a dark cellar. But yeah, a lot of bottles have obviously been sitting around places in not ideal condition yet to be stored. But rare champagne.
Which whiskey just doesn't have that, which is like, for me, people are like, hey, listen, my house is climate controlled. You know, it's like, it's all, like some of it's behind firewalls. You know, God forbid something went wrong in the house. And stuff like that. But it's like, whiskey doesn't require the babysitting of champagne and wine.
Correct. Yeah. And that's one of its great advantages. I know, but one of the things which is interesting in the marketplace is the packaging is important. And wine, original wooden case or whatever it is, adds some value, but it's much less than in the whiskey business, where the packaging and the appearance of the bottle and the appearance of the packaging, etc., is much more important than wine.
Well, if you think of like Distillers 101, like I went in between lunch and like the next event, I went with Johnny into like the side house of Hope Tune, which is like, you know, obviously bigger house than I could ever live in. And it was like the preparation house. And they had all the boxes of all of the items that were up for auction. I mean, some of them you could put a human body in, you know, like the Bowmore one, the Boro one, like you could, huge boxes to put these massive pizzas. So the packaging was a big part of it too.
And you need it to protect those, yeah, wherever they're going to end up around the world, you need to protect those works of art, because yeah, the bottles and the yeah, what they come with are a lot of work being put into that, not just the liquid.
Oh, a full show. I mean, and I think that just goes back to like the whole pomp and ceremony. But then like I walked away from that event going like, you know what, if money was no object, and I'm not talking about lots of money, I'm talking about a good amount, like obviously you're well off, like purchasing that entire collection for your home bar could just be like game over. Like you've reached the top of the mountain, it's done. Like, what did you go? I got like 33 bottles from, you know, Distillers 101. I paid like $4 million, you know, with all the fee. Oh, hey, dude, that's cool. Hey, how's your new Maserati yacht going? Yeah, it's pretty cool. I like it. Oh, Lamborghini yacht. Yeah, it's cool, but look at my bar. I mean, like, like I have to go back to those perspectives, you know, being around those people that have, you know, for lack of better words, fuck you money. Like, that's not a bad fucking bar to have if you were able to pick that all up or be focused to go and do that.
Yeah, I mean, but what's interesting is in the big scheme of things, and compared to some of the big, you know, wine and whiskey collections, that's not so much money.
No.
You know, that would buy you a unique collection of something that no one else has got. Yeah.
No, I mean, we were at, you know, a night before, we were at a Glentard event, and I got to taste, the night before, I got to taste what was going to be up on auction with one of the watch companies. And there was an Asian gentleman in the crowd, and he was like, literally, and I think that, you know, they were expecting it to go for like north of $200,000. And this kid, and I'm calling him out of respect, he's in his mid-20s, you know, and he's like, well, let me call my family office and see if I can buy it tomorrow. It was just that matter of factly, you know, it's like, let me call my family office and I'll see, like, if they approve me for like a quarter mil, I'll just grab it tomorrow because I really like this. And he was going to drink it. Like, he can give a shit about it, investing in it. It's just, it's the level that he was flying at, you know, as a family member. And I'm like, dude, that's a pretty fucking good call to be able to make.
That is a good call. I tell you what, that brings up an interesting point in that, because the block bar audience is obviously, it's traditionally savvy. And, you know, 90% of the audience is millennial and Gen Z. 70% of the bars are millennial and Gen Z. And, you know, they think of money and value in a different perspective to the older generations. You know, the older generations, if they're buying a pair of sneakers, you know, maybe 100, 150 is their cap. You know, the millennials and Gen Z see a pair of Golden Gooses, and they're like, you know, I'll have those at 600. So it's sort of really interesting, the different value perspectives. And well, we talk maybe somewhat negatively about premiumization. You know, that the younger generation, they do want to drink better. They want to share things with their friends. They want to have special experiences. So whilst they might not drink as much, they're drinking better than the previous generation. Do you see that?
100%, because of social media. They can timestamp the experience for everybody to see. Couldn't do that. You know, you know, you've hung around with some very wealthy people. I've hung around, like, they don't have social media. They sit in their wine room outside the wine cave in their house, and they smoke a cigar, and they, you know, maybe talk inappropriately about things that you might want to talk about, but they do, and then that's it. The new generation is like, I'm popping that bottle, taking a picture, taking it in the back of the Rolls Royce, and that's what we're doing today. Just for fun, because I can.
Yep.
All of my stories on TikTok. Yeah. Like, whoa, you're like, whoa.
And you can do that, you know, with a bottle of whiskey, you know, several times, or just once with a bottle of wine.
Yeah. All that, I mean, and continue to show it. I mean, when I was in Ibiza last year for summer, you know, watching what bottle service was like in one of the clubs, you know, and it was all about taking a video of it. It wasn't necessarily like, hey, what you're drinking. It's like, hey, can you video the incredibly good looking waitress opening the bottle? Yeah. We don't care. I mean, I watched these five guys from London who had their own private security guy with them. And he had like a, you know, we would call it over here, I don't know, a MERS, a fanny pack over his shoulder that was just full of cash. And we're at this club and there's probably 30 tables in bottle service. And all of a sudden the waitresses are like, you can't get a waitress. And I look over and they've got five of the, they're all good looking, but like the five top ones giving these five guys head and neck massages. And the security guys just handing money over. And we all laughed up there. We're like, dude, I mean, hey, listen, not a bad idea, boys. And they were young kids. I'm like, not a bad idea.
Yeah.
But it was, so, all about filming.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, and so I think the younger generation is so super interesting for the whiskey and the spirits business as to how do they engage with them? What's the rate of consumption? You know, what is...
And the education. And the education, yeah. Jamie, I think like what they're lacking is what I try. Like I use Rolex whiskey as a platform for education. Like I, you know, when I work with brands, it's more like, hey, you took the time to tell me about your brand. I'm going to tell the whole world then about it.
And that, like, that's fantastically valuable.
Well, and to me, it's like, you know, that Rolex whiskey came about as like, it was funny. I was buying whiskey, posting pictures with my Rolexes on it. And people were like, oh shit, I like this. But it never meant to grow. Once I saw it growing, I'm like, I'm going to focus on creating a global audience, because what does every whiskey brand want is a global audience. Nobody wants to be like, hey, I make the best whiskey in Miami. I'd love everyone in Miami to be drinking it. That's not really a good cash model. But there's so much, and there's so many whiskey companies that don't have budgets, like the big ones we spoke about earlier that make amazing whiskey. And I'm like, if you take the time just to show me around and taste me in a couple of things, like I document all of that. And I might even like, you know, like it was interesting because at last year's One of One, like I had never drank the Macduff, and whatever they poured, me and Fowler looked at each other and we're like, dude, that was one of the best pours we had today. Like who, what the, obviously he knew about them. I didn't, because I'd never like, oh, tell me about this, you know? But I was like, wow, there's a lot of great Scotch whiskey out there. There's great spirits. I mean, obviously in America, Japan, India, like all over, there's a lot of great spirits that just don't have the financial ability to be the time of day. I mean, I posted the other day and I said, listen, my collection's primarily mixtures for bourbon, and I got a lot of bourbon, and Suntory for Japanese. And then when it comes to Scotch, like I'm heavy in Macallan, because it goes down to liquidity. At the point that I decide to close this investment strategy, I need to know that pretty much it'll move immediately. But personally, I drink all the independent bottles because, like, the whiskey is, unfortunately, it's true. It just is sometimes better because it's not following a spec. It's the spec of the house, but not the spec of the core.
Yeah, it's mostly individual cask being bottled, and they have the true integrity of that cask. Yeah.
Which I think, like, with Block Bar, you have this great opportunity because, obviously, you know, family's very pedigree that are behind it. They have a lot of great relationships. You have the provenance. You've put out some amazing releases, but like, I think like you're just getting started.
Yeah, but we're definitely just getting started. I mean, yeah, we've done some fun things here. We did the Middleton Very Rare, you know, the other day, which was in auction. Obviously, I come from a variable pricing background with Sotheby's, so I love the variable pricing, so whether that's auction, leaderboards, you know, sale bids, etc. And so, yeah, but I think, you know, you're right. We're just getting started. We're only a 2-year-old company. So yeah, we're at the very beginning of forward, and as you said earlier, yeah, we're a new direct to consumer channel. So
exactly,
I think, yeah, that and for me, you know, I've only been on board for 8 months, but it's like it's super exciting. You know, we have a very young team. I'm by far the oldest by a long way, and our technology, you know, compared to working with a more established company which has legacy systems, yeah, our technology is phenomenal. What we can do, you know, in a short amount of time, it was amazing. So, I think the growth and the future, and you know, one of the things which is, you know, at the beginning of the business, a lot of people did, you know, one-off projects with us. Then they're realizing now that essentially this is an audience you need to grow and bring along, and you want to have loyalty with, and they want to understand and be loyal to you, but they need, you know, something in return. So we're now talking to businesses about, you know, more of a 3-5 year plan where there's a series of releases that make sense rather than just one-off individuals.
Well, correct, because like at the end of the day, I think a large part of that base are their collectors, and what's better than having a series, you know? Yeah. Like the series, because the series also, like for me, when I collect like entire series with a Suntory or Macallan to the best of my financial ability, of course, you know, depending on what where I see the value on it. But like, there's like a sense of fulfillment slash kind of like an addiction that you've got to finish it. Yeah. You know, like, what's the point? Like, I got four of the five bottles. Like, why would I, you know, like, if I think of like Macallan, you know, the edition series one through six, you know, I walked into a liquor store randomly when edition two was on the street and I had tried it. And he had a bunch of ones and it hadn't hit yet. Like, nobody knew what was going to happen there, that an $89 bottle can go to $3,000. Like, nobody saw that coming. But the guy had it in the store. And I'm like, I'll take, like, I think he had 12 left. I'll take a dozen. And I still had like the nerve to ask, because I did this back in those days. This is like, you know, early 2016, early 2017. I'm like, well, if I buy them all, can you give me a discount? And he's like, sure, I'll give you 20% off. And I'm like, great. Having no idea, Jamie, no idea like that was going to happen. It was more like people say, well, how did you pick and choose your whiskeys? I'm like, that you put in your collection. I'm a lot. I just went with my gut. I hope my gut was right. But I was kind of like, man, like, so with that one, it was more like an, I call them like there was blood in the water and I'm the shark. And I'm like, well, this guy's willing to give me at a discount. And this number two is pretty good. And I really didn't even like number one, but like, wouldn't hurt for me to, I can afford to do it. What's the worst that can happen? I sell them or I drink them. Like, I don't care. And then number three came out and all of a sudden it started to move. And I'm like, oh shit, that's just being in the moment. And the problem is now, you can't be in the moment. You can't walk into liquor stores and that happen anymore. But something like Block Bar, if you move quickly, you can be there.
Yep,
you got to move quickly, though.
But yeah, we have no gating system on it. And so you have to, there are other sites with subscriptions, et cetera. We don't do that. So it's, so you've got to move quickly. But it's just like, as you said, otherwise it's like hunting and pecking around the world trying to find stuff. So it's,
and paying premiums. And also the saddest part, not knowing if it's real.
Yeah,
like, you know, exactly. It's like there are stores throughout the world that sell fake shit. They just are. And they're hoping that you have no idea. And you, most people won't have any idea.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, by far. I mean, yeah, the fakes, apart from when they're done really badly or obviously, are actually challenging to pick up or not for someone who's not, reasonably well-versed in what they're doing.
Well, and also, like, who do you have around from that time period to confirm? You know, like, I spoke to a gentleman who works for another auction house, and they recently, not recently, like a year ago, sold a very expensive bottle of whiskey, and they had to put, they said, hey, listen, we're putting in a hypodermic needle in there. We're extracting a little bit of liquid. We'll document the whole thing. But we just want to test this, because, like, you don't have any provenance, nothing. And I'm like, how do you find someone around from 1968 that made the whiskey? He's like, dude, that's not easy. But there's telltale signs from those whiskeys, from those periods, because they didn't have the technology that we have today. So they all had like their own DNA that was just relative to the period.
They could compare the the syringe liquid with them.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
That's an important part. Yeah.
And it worked. Well, and that's 100% worked out. It was great. Everything went good. But he was real interesting because they had a little bit extra of the sample. So he got to try it. And he's like, that was fucking crazy. he's like, we're gonna put it back in. I tested, and he's like, I got to like just wet my beak just a little bit. He's like, that was good whiskey from that beer. I'm like, well, it's good to know. I mean, I wish I had 1.2 mil to go buy the bottle, but we're good.
Yeah, that's great,
James.
And so, hey, I'm just gonna talk super you about the about Rolex whiskey. So, when you first came up with the name, was that just sort of like a bit of fun, and then it suddenly worked out? Because it's on reflection, it's a brilliant name.
Okay, so I wasn't the one that came up with the name. I'll full disclosure, this is how it went down. I was buying whiskey, I was posting it. I owned, I think at that point, like three Rolexes, and my shtick was every now and again I would throw a Rolex on a bottle, but I wasn't doing consistently. And then I was talking to two gentlemen that were kind of like, to me, they were a big deal on social media at that point in time. And the one guy was like, dude, like, cause I'm like, what should I call myself? Like, I can't just be like whatever I want. I think I was like Rolex Explorer, Jamie, back then. I was like, I would literally take the kids to soccer and put a Rolex Hulk in the grass and take a picture and be like, hey, just another day at soccer. Like, I forget what my original name was, but like, I was really like, the concept originally was like Rolexes on the move, cruising around, doing things. like a Lego piece is where I was thinking, like a little Lego man, except it was a Rolex watch.
Yep.
And then one of the guys is like, well, you keep on putting, why don't you just call yourself Rolex Whiskey and make that your signature? That's what you do. You put a watch on a bottle and that's just your signature move. And I was like, fuck, I like that. And that's how it started.
That's cool. I love it. That was a great suggestion.
Oh, 100%. And like, if I think, like, for me, it's like, I grew up in South Africa. I saw people wearing Rolexes every now and again. And to me, as a young kid, it associated with people that just hustled a little hard. You know, they weren't the average work type. They were like, they would try to figure out a way to efficiently make more money without having to clock a 9 to 5. Various reasons.
That's it.
Okay?
Yeah.
And I was like, a little bit of money in my pocket. I mean, I worked 3 jobs to get my first one when I was 25. And I said, every 5 years, I'm going to buy a new one. And my goal is to get one per series, you know, and then be done. Like, I'm good. The nicest one in each series. And that's how that whole thing started. When I turned 30, I got another one. Turned 35, got another one. Life wasn't good for me between 35 and 40. And I actually, at one point, took all 3 of them to a pawn shop. And the guy gave me like some ridiculous low offer. And I'm like, I don't know, but keep them because I just need the money. And I remember driving home, like just depressed. And I'm like, I'll go stand on a street corner before I sell these things. And I called him, I'm like, I'll be back tomorrow to pick them up. And like everything just turned around from that point because it put that fight instinct back into me that maybe hadn't been around for a minute. And like it all just changed. But I always like, I'll always be loyal to Rolex because like Rolex is. Every watch has so much history for me on what I did in my life. And I want to pass them on to the kids one day and I might engrave, you know, everyone has been bought for an occasion. I'm going to engrave that kind of stuff. So for me, it's like, I don't care about any other watches. Like I like Rolex. I like watches I can wear every day. I'm not a watch guy. I wear one watch. I happen to wear that's Rolex, but like that's my lean, you know? And it was the same with whiskey. I grew up drinking J&B and Shivers. Like, I didn't know fucking whiskey. And then I started buying it as an investment and then trying it. And I'm like, whoa, there's all new levels to this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've crushed a lot of time. And I want to ask you one final question. And we can probably do this again for sure, because I definitely want to talk more about Block Bar. Is there a whiskey experience for you that really stands out where you're like, holy shit, can't believe I'm doing this?
The first one was really when I... Yeah, when we first started getting into the whiskey business and putting together the ultimate whiskey collection, which was a big deal for us at that time, launching that business. Kirk and McAllen, inviting me up there and I went and visited and toured McAllen and stayed at East Elgin's house. And it was just, that for me was just like, I learned so much in that trip and that was really my first visit, my first big eye-opening to the world of whiskey and how it worked and, the fact that, the same spirit, same mate goes into each cask. That to me is just like such a memorable time because it was really my initiation into the world of whiskey. Yeah, I've been fortunate to do other things and to start understanding, the differences between, as the market evolved, obviously Scotch took off first, then Japanese, then American. And to understand the differences between them, the different markets, placing. And obviously now, I was in Ireland for the Middleton Very Rare a few weeks ago. And so, for me, it's just being a fascinating learning curve and something that's really enjoyable because, I love wine. I've been wine for a long time, but this is a whole new journey for me. I find it absolutely fascinating, the different flavors, the different nuances, the different subtleties. And I think that, for me, the skill of the master distiller and the blenders, It's just incredible. It's like a quarterback who can throw, a ball to precision. How these people can craft these amazing whiskies with these different flavors, and know what they've got about in their warehouses is truly incredible for me.
Well, so I did restaurants and nightclubs for 20 years, and when my wife and I first started dating, she would be at the house when I got off work at like 1 in the morning, and I would like literally put Iron Chef on to just like dumb my brain down. Like the joke would be like I'd used my 2,000 words for the night. I'd spoken to everyone. I'd like done the highest level of customer service and I'm done. I just want to shut up and just be mindless. So I look at these distillers like Iron Chefs. Like they give them all the same grains. You know, and there's nuances. I'm not, you know, obviously there's nuances to it. They give them the same thing called water, and obviously there's nuances to it. And they bring the best out of it, all in their own styles.
100%. 100%.
You know, and you know that feeling when you meet that person, that Iron Chef, and they're just telling you about it. You're like, holy shit. Like some of them are like, you know, you sit down with them and they'll pull out something from 35, 40 years ago. And they're like, I didn't realize it was going to come out this good, to be honest, when we put it down 35, 40 years ago. I mean, we hoped.
Yeah. And normally they're pretty modest, passionate people. Yeah.
Very.
Modest people with a big passion.
Yeah. And this one guy was like, yeah, we weren't really sure on this one. It was like, it was a different. I still remember this putting it in barrel going, guys, I don't know if this is going to be something in the future. You know, this, we might have over tweaked this one.
Right. And you know what? They're doing it for the next generation in the most.
Yes.
Yeah. And so
I mean, there's also that sadness, as you know, you and me are not 21 anymore, but you know, unfortunately, I'm seeing more and more that the next generation is sitting behind a computer. And that's okay. You know, another food analogy there is like, because I've been with all these guys, the whiskey we're drinking now is the cleanest whiskey ever. So my analogy is like, you take a really good piece of meat and you make it in a nonstick pan. It's going to be a really good piece of meat. But you take a really good piece of meat and you put it in a seasoned skillet that you've been using for years, it's a little different. It's got an extra wow, but I get it. And like, you know, I've been going to distilleries right now, and I've been talking about this for years. It's like, man, all I see is diodes and computers and like screens everywhere. Like, I want to go back to where like the dude was like just putting his finger in there and trying it.
And the skill of these people and just like, and how they carve it. And the fact that they're using liquid laid down by other distillers, and their liquid can be used by future distillers. So it's a fascinating process.
It was interesting, like the latest Michter's 25 bourbon. The best thing I've drank. And there was a lot of reason. First of all, it wasn't Joe's liquid. You know, they had bought that liquid. Yeah. But they had been caring for it for like the last 15 years, like nurturing it and just constantly just so much extra love was being given to something that was already great that like it just knocked my socks off. And you could feel all that passion that had been going on.
And that's what's amazing about the whiskey business, yeah.
Well, Jamie, we killed some time really fast. I love talking to you. We got to do more of this. Do you want to give any of your social media plugs or anything to my listeners?
So, blogbar.east is our mine's Jamie Ritchie Wine is my Instagram. Blogbar.com is where you find us. We have a Blogbar app as well. And if anyone wants to reach out to me, feel free to do so.
That was awesome, my friend. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for listening. You know how I feel about Blogbar. Get registered on the system. If you have any questions, ask. It is that easy, but it might not be if you first looked at it. So call, hit help. They got concierges. They got people. Call me. I've been on since day one. Like, call, get all the Jamie. Like, we want you on there getting the opportunity to buy. That's just the bottom line, because it's really cool stuff that's coming up. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Continue to rate my show. Loving all the data. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I will continue to bring great people on the show, but I can't do it without all of you listening. So I appreciate everybody. Until next time, we're done.